Chapter 32, Memento Mori. To begin depriving death of its greatest advantage over us, let us adopt a way clean contrary to that common one. Let us deprive death of its strangeness. Let us frequent it. Let us get used to it. Let us have nothing more often in mind than death. We do not know where death awaits us, so let us wait for it everywhere. To practice death is to practice freedom. A man who has learned how to die has unlearned how to be a slave. Michael de Montaigne. What's the last thing I want to say? What does it all come down to? If I could only have ever delivered one lesson, what would it be? What is the single most important message I could share? What is the diamond at the core of all spiritual aspiration? What topic is befitting not just my own farewell to the teaching gig, but a farewell to Brett? These were the questions I put to myself when I decided to come meet Brett's group and say goodbye with them. And as soon as I asked the question, I knew the answer. Memento mori. Remember, you must die. How bad can all this spiritual stuff get? What's the worst-case scenario? These can be very scary and paralyzing questions to leave open-ended, especially when we set out alone on a journey beyond the charted regions of the map. The answer to these questions, happily, is death. Death is as bad as it can get. Death is the worst-case scenario. That's where this whole thing ends up. That's the full extent of the downside. You are going to die. And of course, you're going to die anyway, so it's really kind of a non-issue. I have always found this simple observation both comforting and empowering. My own journey was made possible by having that question, how bad can this really get, neatly tied off at the end. Death is absolute. Unlike anything else in the dream state, death is clearly seen and certainly known. It is where we are going, whether we take this journey or not. No matter what you do, no matter how horrible it gets, it doesn't just keep getting worse and worse forever. There's an end to it. And since I'm going to die anyway, and it's only a matter of when, the simple fact is that it really can't get bad at all. This casual treatment of death is not meant to minimize the agony of peeling off your skin in layers as you divest yourself of emotional content and connections. That's the gruesome part. But the fact is that these wounds heal instantly. Rather, no wound remains. Gone is gone. Done is done. With every step we leave behind that which we move beyond. No baggage is carried because releasing baggage is the essence of progress. The pain-giving thing is the thing removed. When it's gone, so is the pain. All that's left in its place is relief and a mild, short-lived curiosity. It's like pulling a bad tooth or ripping off a bandage. The tough part is the fear before and the pain during. There's no phantom limb syndrome haunting us after we've amputated a gangrenous piece of emotional meat. There's just a pleasant nothing until a new pain announces itself and the next cycle begins. It is later now, nearly 10 o'clock. While everyone made their way down to the lake to have some more snacks and get themselves situated for the shank of the evening, Lisa and I walked up to the house and talked to Melissa. We'd met with her earlier and given her the jewelry box containing the gift we'd be presenting her with later. She'd known about it for months, but I still didn't want her seeing it for the first time in front of a crowd. Best to let her spend some private time with it first. Now I get it back from her and walk down to the lake to join the others. Lisa stays with Melissa. We have arrived at the heart of the evening. I will do some speaking. We will introduce Brett's daughter, Melissa, and make a small presentation. Then Lisa and I will make our exit so we can take a nice drive on the Blue Ridge Parkway, and I can catch a red eye for Denver. Behind me is the fire. Above me, a bright moon occasionally obscured by silvery wisps of clouds. The lake is to my left, a large fenced field to my right. And in front of me sit nearly 100 people in orderly rows of folding chairs, a large white party tent behind them. The light rain will stop and start throughout the rest of the evening, but we'll never need to take shelter from it. The orderliness of the seating, I realize, is unpleasant to look at. It creates an invisible proscenium where I and the fire are on stage, and they in their chairs are in the audience. I tell everyone to pick up their chair and move closer to form a semicircle around me and the fire. After a minute or two, it's done, and the whole thing is more intimate. I throw more logs on the fire while they settle in. I await their attention and soon have it. I pull the small box out of my pocket. It's made of black walnut with a glass window in the top, so you can see what's inside without opening it. Inside, on a bed of black satin, is a single diamond, not small, on a thin gold necklace. Everyone who sees it oohs and ahs over it. I hold it up and watch it sparkle in the firelight. I hand the box and a small keychain flashlight to someone in the front row. "This is what we're giving Melissa in remembrance of Brett," I say. "I hope you'll all appreciate the symbology represented by the diamond. Pass it around. Here we go." "You heard Lisa talk earlier," I begin. "She showed you a picture, passed it around. She told you about a woman who got up one pretty September morning, got dressed, got her family's day started, and made the commute to work. Just another day. Nothing unusual to indicate that on this day she would have to stand in a blown-out window and choose between an inferno and a 1,000-foot fall." I have their attention. Some look around for Lisa, but she's still up at the house with Melissa. "What Lisa showed you was the real Zen, the unknown Zen, the Zen that doesn't sell. That photograph of a woman who had just jumped out of a burning skyscraper was Lisa's koan. Like a badass demon, it got its hooks into her and wouldn't let go. That time she spent staring at the picture and contemplating its meaning was her meditation, her zazen. Over the course of 3 years, her koan devoured her. It got in and metastasized through her system like a cancer. Eventually, despite her resistance, it killed her." I pause for a drink. "Memento mori means remember your death. Remember, you must die. That's what Lisa was doing. Her practice of communing with that picture for an hour or more every day is a perfect example of memento mori as a spiritual practice. Death awareness is a vehicle out of the state of death denial in which we reside. Lisa's experience. What happened to her? The profound reorganization her life underwent as a result is what happens when we make this transition. I pace and watch the flames for a moment. We live in fear of death. We don't want to think about it. We don't want to look at it. We don't even want to acknowledge that it exists. We just want to go about our lives and not be reminded of our mortality. So we try to minimize it in three ways. First, we push death off into the distant future, so it's not something we have to think about right now. We'll probably die when we're 80 or 90, and we'll probably be too soft in the head to know what's happening anyway, so we don't have to worry about it. They laugh, despite themselves. Another way we reduce death to something we can deal with is by stripping it of its finality through our afterlife beliefs, heaven and rebirth mainly. For most of us, these beliefs are just strong enough to serve the purpose of getting death out of our face. Out of sight, out of mind, right? No one says wrong. A third tactic we use in our practice of death denial is constant distraction. We keep ourselves from thinking by keeping busy, by keeping our attention outwardly focused on the myriad trivialities of life. The Holy Trinity is home, work, and family. But then we have others as well to fill the gaps as needed. Sports, shopping, books and television, addictions, hobbies, and so on. I pause and pace, pace and consider. So one, death is not for a long time and we'll probably be too senile to care. Two, it's not an end like it seems. It's just a transition to something else. And three, we keep ourselves perpetually distracted. Between these three denial tactics, death is not an important presence in our lives. It's with us every moment, but never in front of us, where we have to look at it and think about it. This is how we keep death out of sight, behind us, instead of in front of us. This is how we maintain the state of death denial that allows us to go about our lives in a state of virtual unconsciousness. That was the establishing shot, an overview of our subject and our relationship to it. Now I'd like to provide everyone with a close-up. It's a well-worn cliche that we don't know how precious something is until we lose it. It's a cliché that when someone has a close brush with mortality, they develop a newfound appreciation for life. Suddenly, everything is beautiful and glorious. Each day is a gift. Everything takes on new meaning and all that. Very powerful and eye-opening and perspective-giving. We call this a wake-up call, and that's exactly what it is. Is everybody familiar with this? Hands? All hands go up. Maybe from TV and movies. Who's seen it up close? Most of the hands go down. And who's experienced it for themselves? Only two or three people keep their hands raised. I point to one, a young guy named Terry. What happened?
I fell off a scaffold at work, he says. I heard the paramedics say I wouldn't make it. And then in the emergency room, too, I could tell they didn't think I'd survive.
And?
Well, I survived, obviously. And then it was like you described. I had this really sincere, profound appreciation for everything. I couldn't understand why everyone wasn't that way all the time. Like, how can everyone not see this?
He chokes up a bit, but goes on.
I mean, it just changed the way I saw everything. It changed my whole outlook.
And how long did that last? Well, it's still with me, but not really, I say. That creates a hush. All eyes turn to Terry. No, he says with a sigh. I guess not. It's just a memory now. It's nothing like it was, but I wish it was. I felt really alive for, well, probably less than a week, I guess. But it was real. It was like the most real thing I've ever experienced. Like that was real life. And this is just sort of, well, like you say, I guess, like being asleep. I promised myself I wouldn't let it slip away, like Lisa talked about. But I did. And now everything is just pretty much regular again. So this wasn't a cliché for you? Oh, no. No way, he says with palpable sincerity. It's the most alive I've ever felt, just like you talk about. Like I woke up for a little while, but I couldn't stay that way. Like I just closed my eyes and drifted back to the way I was before the accident. Or like life just dragged me back down. It's kind of sad to think about it now, that I'm like normal again and everything. I felt like I was finally born, like I really knew what life was for the first time. That's what I thought life should be like, all the time. I still do. That's why I started getting into spirituality and coming to see Brett in the first place. I was trying to recapture that sense of intense aliveness. I still am, I guess. And how's that going for you? He shakes his head. Not very good. Only that day dawns, to which we are awake, I say. Thoreau said that. Only that day dawns, to which we are awake. It sounds like just a pretty sentiment, but it's really a nanobomb, like Lisa's picture, like a virus, a tiny little bug that can slip in and spread and eventually topple a giant. Or so you'd think, anyway. The fact is that Maya's autoimmune system is quite robust and well able to fend off these pesky little microbes. You heard what Lisa did. She had the photo, and it got damaged, so she got another one and laminated it. That's the one she showed you. She developed a kind of an addiction to it. An unhealthy obsession is what I suppose the shrinks would call it. They'd try to put her in therapy and get her going on some meds. Fortunately, she didn't go to a shrink. I throw some more logs on the fire and rearrange it with a shovel. Sparks shoot up into the night and fade and disappear. No matter how we might try to deny it, death is the fact of life. We can turn away from it, but we can't push it away. It's always with us. Brett was just returning some movies, just another errand. For that woman in Lisa's picture, and thousands of others like her, that was just another day at the office. But what that woman found out was that there is no such thing as just another day. Every day is anything can happen day. There is no day, or hour, or moment so mundane that it cannot play host to death. How's that for a scary story? A few somewhat uncomfortable laughs. The diamond is making its way around. I pick up my water bottle and take a drink. I know this sounds simple, and it is. It's the simplest thing there is. The title of the first chapter of my first book was That Which Cannot Be Simpler. And that's what we always come back to. Simplicity. Burn it all and see what's left. When we do that here in the dream state, what we find out doesn't burn is death. That's what's left when everything else is gone. Death is what survives. I pull the sheet of paper out of my pocket and unfold it. Here's something Emerson wrote. One of the illusions is that the present hour is not the critical, decisive hour. Write it on your heart that every day is the best day in the year. No man has learned anything rightly until he knows that every day is doomsday. Write it on your heart, I repeat. Every day is the best day of your life. Death gives definition to life. Death awareness is life awareness. Death denial is life denial. Here's something Mozart wrote in a letter to his father. I have formed during the last few years such a close relationship with this best and truest friend of mankind that death's image is not only no longer terrifying to me, but is indeed very soothing and consoling. And I thank my God for graciously granting me the opportunity of learning that death is the key which unlocks the door to our true happiness. I put the paper away. What we're talking about here tonight is what you all heard Lisa describe: becoming conscious within the dream state, waking up in life. She didn't talk about her years as an apprentice shaman in the Amazon, or the time she spent researching ancient parchments in the catacombs beneath the Vatican or the Topala. She didn't talk about figuring this out like a puzzle where you're always scrounging for the next piece. She talked about becoming death aware, plain and simple. The reason we get bogged down in all the weird and exotic spiritual stuff is to avoid the up-close and personal stuff. We search the most distant places and times because we don't want to deal with the here and now. We eagerly subscribe to arcane, intelligence-insulting belief systems because they are, by their very design, conducive to the sleep state we wish to maintain. Religion and spirituality exist to serve our need for death denial. They serve as lullabies and drown out the ticking of the clock. We spend our lives and our life force running away from this monster we call death. This state of incessant denial takes all our time and energy. That's where our lives go. That's how we spend them. That's what it means to be asleep within the dream. I take a question, and that turns into another question, and we spend the next few minutes getting all this figured out together. I ask them what they thought we were so afraid of, why we were so desperate to deny the reality of our mortality. And they offered some suggestions, and we discussed them, but found them all unsatisfying. No one seemed to feel that we were afraid of the actual state of being dead, or that it was the actual dying part that was so scary. Everyone seemed to agree that death sucked, and they didn't like the idea of it. But no one could really say why until a strangely, sagely teenage boy, sitting between his mom and dad, stated the answer like a pronouncement. Futility, he said, like music to my ears. Futility, I echo. No belief is true. Life has no meaning. Nothing we do matters. All is vanity and a striving after wind. We're going to die, and it will be as if we never lived. Everything we think is true is false. all our beliefs are delusions, and everything we know is a lie. There is no such thing as success. Nothing we do can make any possible difference. No matter how fast we go or how far ahead we are not going anywhere. The best and the brightest are in a dead tie with the worst and the dimmest. These are the facts of life. Simple, obvious, plain to behold, yet universally unrecognized and unacknowledged. This is what it means to see what's not and not see what is, to be in denial, to be asleep within the dream, to reside in the womb of the unborn. We are madly, desperately, insanely afraid of the truth, and it is that fear that walls us off from our unbounded nature. It is the emotional energy of fear that erects and maintains the egoic shell. Then this sort of death awareness you're talking about, says Shanti, memento mori, I interrupt. Remember, you must die. Death awareness. Okay, memento mori, she says, but that's not what you did. This wasn't your practice, was it? Yes and no, I say. I began my journey from the very first instant with the knowledge that my life was forfeit. That was a lock, and I was unspeakably happy to make that bargain. My fogged-in little nothing of a life in exchange for clarity? Of course, total no-brainer. There was never the slightest hesitation. Would you trade nothing for everything? By the time you understand the question, you've already answered it. But you're not dead, she says reasonably. The person to whom that happened no longer exists, I say. And what I am now lives in constant death awareness. It is suffused throughout my dream state being the way fear and death denial used to be. Death is always before my eyes. I never hide it or deny it or push it away. Death is the diamond heart of my dream state being. It is the defining feature that shows me the value of everything I see. I let them think about that while I kick at the fire. I turn back to them. I've said this before, I continue. I love the fact of my death. It has made my life possible. There could have been no awakening without it. It's how I know the value of things. It's how I know what beauty is. It's why I am gratitude-based instead of fear-based. It's also how I know child from adult, asleep from awake. It's how I can look at someone and know if death walks before them or behind. I turn it back on them. This isn't about death in the abstract. It's about death in the most personal, intimate sense. Your death. Death is the meaning in the dream. The dream state shadow of no self. Death is the boogeyman. You can't kill him, or hide from him, or get away from him. You can only turn toward him or away from him. If you turn toward him, befriend him, fully embrace him, not superficially, but as your own essential truth, then death is the demon you can ride into every battle the way Brett rode her father demon, the way Lisa rode that photo koan. What do you recommend we do? Asks Justin with a touch of sarcasm. Hang out in graveyards? Hell yes, I say. Cemeteries are wonderful places to walk and think. Buy yourself a burial plot and have your lunch there every day. Order your headstone. A glimpse of your own mortality really puts things in perspective. Isn't that what people say? Well, that's what you want to do. See your own mortality. Put things in perspective. There are lots of ways you could raise your awareness. Study photos of people like yourself, now dead. Read books about death and suicide. Carry poison in your pocket and contemplate it often. Walk along high ledges. Lie down on railroad tracks and read poetry. Put a loaded gun in your mouth and cock it. I myself enjoy sitting on the ledges of tall buildings at night, looking out over the city and down at the street below, my feet dangling over nothingness. I like walking in thunderstorms where lightning could strike me down at any instant. I guess all this sounds extreme, but I don't see how anything could be too extreme. The idea is right. Put yourself in close proximity to death. Every hour, every day, you want to be taking time to immerse yourself in the mindset of death awareness, of time awareness, of the fact that the clock is ticking, that every day is one day less, that every breath you take is one breath less. Measure your life in weeks or months instead of years, and take somber note of their passing. Take time every morning to understand what it means to have a new day. Etch the words, "Only that day dawns to which I am awake," into your bathroom mirror. The contemplation of death, of one's own mortality, is a real and powerful meditation. Death awareness is true Zazen. It's the universal spiritual practice, the only one anyone ever needs, and the one everyone should perform. So, yes, you'd want to do whatever you have to in order to bring this living awareness into your life. Develop the habit of thinking of death every time you look at a watch or clock, every time you sit down to a meal, every time you go to the bathroom. Take a walk alone every day and think about what it means to be alive, to walk, to see and hear, to breathe. It's not an exercise. It's not something you're trying to make yourself believe, like an affirmation. It's something that's real and central to your every thought and act. If you knew you were going to die tomorrow, what would you do today? And why the hell aren't you doing it? Chapter 33. To be or not to be. Awareness of death is the very bedrock of the entire path. Until you have developed this awareness, all practices are obstructed. His Holiness the Dalai Lama. When you start preparing for death, you soon realize that you must look into your life now and come to face the truth of yourself. Death is like a mirror in which the true meaning of life is reflected. Sogyal Rinpoche. For those who seek to understand it, death is a highly creative force. The highest spiritual values of life can originate from the thought and study of death. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Without being mindful of death, whatever Dharma practices you take up will be merely superficial. Milarepa. For any culture which is primarily concerned with meaning, the study of death, the only certainty that life holds for us, must be central. For an understanding of death is the key to liberation in life. Stanislav Grof. I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately, to front only the essential facts of life, and see if I could not learn what it had to teach, and not, when I came to die, discover that I had not lived. Henry David Thoreau. We say that the hour of death cannot be forecast, but when we say this, we imagine that hour as placed in an obscure and distant future. It never occurs to us that it has any connection with the day already begun, or that death could arrive this same afternoon, this afternoon which is so certain and which has every hour filled in advance. Marcel Proust. To fear death, my friends, is only to think ourselves wise without being wise. For it is to think that we know what we do not know. For anything that men can tell, death may be the greatest good that can happen to them. But they fear it, as if they knew quite well that it was the greatest of evils. And what is this but that shameful ignorance of thinking that we know what we do not know? Socrates. It is not the end of the physical body that should worry us. Rather, our concern must be to live while we are alive, to release our inner selves from the spiritual death that comes with living behind a facade designed to conform to external definitions of who and what we are. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Someday I'll be a weather-beaten skull resting on a grass pillow, serenaded by a stray bird or two. Kings and commoners end up the same, no more enduring than last night's dream. Ryokan. It's only when we truly know and understand that we have a limited time on earth, and that we have no way of knowing when our time is up, we will then begin to live each day to the fullest, as if it was the only one we had. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. I said to life, I would hear death speak. And life raised her voice a little higher and said, You hear him now. Khalil Gibran. Death twitches my ear. Live, he says. I am coming. Virgil. They tell us that suicide is the greatest piece of cowardice, that suicide is wrong, when it is quite obvious that there is nothing in the world to which every man has a more unassailable title than to his own life and person. Arthur Schopenhauer. Let death be daily before your eyes, and you will never entertain any abject thought, nor too eagerly covet anything. Epictetus. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walketh in darkness. And I myself perceived also that one event happeneth to them all. Ecclesiastes. By daily dying, I have come to be. Theodore Rothke. The world is so exquisite, with so much love and moral depth, that there is no reason to deceive ourselves with pretty stories for which there's little good evidence. Far better, it seems to me, in our vulnerability, is to look death in the eye and be grateful every day for the brief but magnificent opportunity that life provides. Carl Sagan. Death is our eternal companion. It is always to our left, an arm's length behind us. Death is the only wise advisor that a warrior has. Whenever he feels that everything is going wrong and he's about to be annihilated, he can turn to his death and ask if that is so. His death will tell him that he is wrong, that nothing really matters outside its touch. His death will tell him, "I haven't touched you yet." Carlos Castaneda. Tell your friends, "Look, it's spring. The buds are sweet. The water sparkles. Everyone is joyful. We are going to die." Krishna Mahabharata, Jean-Claude Carrera. All men live enveloped in the whale lines. All are born with halters round their necks. But it is only when caught in the swift, sudden turn of death that mortals realize the silent, subtle, ever-present perils of life. Herman Melville. In the last analysis, it is our conception of death which decides our answers to all the questions life puts to us. Dag Hammarskjöld. Since the death instinct exists in the heart of everything that lives, since we suffer from trying to repress it, since everything that lives longs for rest, let us unfasten the ties that bind us to life. Let us cultivate our death wish. Let us develop it, water it like a plant. Let it grow unhindered. Suffering and fear are born from the repression of the death wish. Eugene Ionesco. There is but one truly serious philosophical problem, and that is suicide. Judging whether life is or is not worth living amounts to answering the fundamental question of philosophy. All the rest, whether or not the world has three dimensions, whether the mind has 9 or 12 categories, comes afterward. These are games. One must first answer. Albert Camus. Live as if you were to die tomorrow. Mahatma Gandhi. Rehearse death. To say this is to tell a person to rehearse his freedom. A person who has learned how to die has unlearned how to be a slave. Lucius Annaeus Seneca. You want to live. But do you know how to live? You are scared of dying. And tell me, is the kind of life you lead really any different from being dead? Lucius Annaeus Seneca. Is not philosophy the study of death? Plato. Death is an endless night so awful to contemplate that it can make us love life and value it with such passion that it may be the ultimate cause of all joy and all art. Paul Thoreau. There is no fundamental difference between the preparation for death and the practice of dying, and spiritual practice leading to enlightenment. Stanislav Grof. Chapter 34, The Ultimate Taboo. Perhaps the whole root of our trouble, the human trouble, is that we will sacrifice all the beauty of our lives. We'll imprison ourselves in totems, taboos, crosses, blood sacrifices, steeples, mosques, races, armies, flags, nations in order to deny the fact of death, which is the only fact we have. James Baldwin. Death is the key to life. Death defines life, gives it shape and meaning and context. Without a clear and honest relationship with our mortality, we live in a state of endless spiritual sprawl, a soupy gray fog that creates the hellish illusion of life stretching endlessly in all directions. We've homogenized our lives by hiding the parts we're afraid of, and in so doing, we've removed all sense of urgency from life. We have taken death out of life, and that allows us to live unconsciously. Death never left, of course. We've just turned away from it, pretended it wasn't there. If we wish to awaken, and that's a mighty big if, then we must welcome death back into our lives. Death is our personal Zen master, our source of power, our path to lucidity. But we have to stop running from it in a blind panic. We need only stop and turn around, and there it is, inches away, staring at us with unblinking gaze, finger poised, every second of our lives. That finger is the one true thing in the dream state, and it will, for a fact, come down. Death awareness is the universal spiritual practice. What we have sought in books and magazines, in teachers and teachings, in ancient cultures and foreign lands, has been breathing down our neck the entire time. It's not just another mood-making spiritual technique that you dabble with for a few weeks and blame yourself when it doesn't deliver. Death always delivers. Death is your only true friend, the only friend that will never abandon you and that no one can take away. It slices through every lie, ridicules every belief, mocks every vanity, and reduces ego to absurdity. He's sitting with you right now. If you want to know something, ask him. Death doesn't lie. The inverse of death awareness is equally important, I continue, seeing both interest and wariness in their firelit faces. Learn to practice death denial awareness. Anytime you find yourself sitting on the couch, watching TV, shopping in a mall, or trying to find amusement in some pointless book or idle pastime, remind yourself that this is exactly the habit you want to break. Try to catch yourself in all the situations throughout the day when you are not awake, not aware, going through the motions of your life in a virtually somnambulistic state. Remind yourself constantly, this moment, right now, I am in the dream state. This is the mindlessness I'm addicted to like a drug. I am an opium addict living in an opium dream. This is the coma, this slow oozing of my life down the drain. Right now, my life is slipping away. I grab my water bottle and take a long drink. Another powerful thing about the practice and cultivation of death awareness is that it provides an accurate barometer of your own spiritual sincerity, though you may not want one. Anyone can go sour on mainstream religion and adopt a less orthodox belief system to replace it. But how many people are really sincere in their spiritual aspirations? Probably all of you think you are, but are you really? Are you willing to go wherever this leads, to do whatever it takes? Thousands talk the talk for one who walks the walk. The practice of death awareness separates the walkers from the talkers. We can use this as a spiritual self-diagnostic to determine, once and for all, if spirituality is something we're serious about or if we're just tourists. Most of us are tourists, but which of us are sincere and which are dabblers? If you want to answer this question for yourself, here's your chance. Your relationship to your own mortality tells the tale. Everyone is either facing toward it or turned away from it. It's that simple. Toward or away. If you can't face the most fundamental fact of your own existence, what can you face? This is ground floor, entry-level awakening. It doesn't get any closer or simpler than this. If, based on this discussion, your life does not undergo major restructuring over the next few months, then you have your answer. You're a tourist with no real desire or intent to wake up. What you do with that knowledge is up to you. Maybe you don't want to know the answer to this question, but if you don't want to know, then you know. I pace back and forth in front of the fire and wonder what Brett would think about what we're doing and saying here tonight. I think she'd be pretty amused by the whole thing. It's not easy to practice death awareness, but you can do it, because it's true. You're going to die. Vigilance is the key. We don't need one wake-up call in life. We need hundreds of wake-up calls every day, more and more, until we actually break the surface and come awake. It takes thought, desire, willful intent. The odds are heavily against you. I doubt even one of you will break this addiction. The sleep state is too comfortable, too hard to rip yourself out of. It's like swimming upward through a mile of mud. You just have to keep at it, keep going, constantly reminding yourself of what you're doing and why. Because as soon as you stop, you start to sink again, and the next thing you know, you'll be sitting in a nursing home thinking back to that long-ago night when some crackpot stood in front of the dancing flames and shooting sparks and told you not to let it slip away. But you did, and now it's too late. There's a long stretch of silence while I mess with the fire. Are you talking about dying well, like how we should meet death when it comes? Asks a woman in jeans and boots and a sheepskin vest. Something like that? Absolutely not, I reply, eager to make this distinction. The point is not to die well. The point is to live well. Who cares how you die? Die bravely or crying like a baby. Who cares? Death awareness is about life awareness, and life awareness is all about waking up. It really has nothing to do with dying. It seems like a very negative, pessimistic way to live, she says. My experience is just the opposite, I reply. Nothing really bothers me. Nothing gets me down. If I lost everything in some tragedy tomorrow, so what? I'm still alive, still here in the funhouse. Who cares about the rest? It's all good. Where's the pessimism in that? Nothing gets you down? Well, that's too broad a statement, I reply. Life could certainly take a downturn I wouldn't wish to endure. The time might come when I would want to grab the bastard's bony finger and give myself the tap. Someone actually gasps. You're not talking about suicide, are you? Asks the woman who looks like a rancher. Is that what you're saying we should think about? I'm not saying what anybody should do, but I'm saying that suicide would be a damn silly thing not to think about. If you can't even consider the topic of ending your life, then whose life is it? Suicide is one of the very few options we might actually have. It means we're not necessarily at death's mercy. It's scary enough to make you sick, but that's no reason not to think about it. Most people treat suicide as the ultimate taboo, as if it's not even on the table. But it is on the table. It's the centerpiece, and there's no reason not to give it the respect it deserves. You can still rule it out, I suppose, but at least it would be you ruling it out instead of having it ruled out for you. Some of them look a little shocked by this. Maybe all this sounds morbid or depressing to you. Maybe you think death is the opposite of life, or that all this death awareness stuff translates into the end of happiness and good times. But this is not the case. Death isn't morbid. Fear is morbid. Death doesn't oppose life. Fear opposes life. To close your eyes to death is to close them to life. What could be more morbid than that? From your perspective, death and suicide are horrific and unthinkable. From my perspective, they are empowering and life-affirming. And I would look at any person that doesn't have an open, honest relationship with these subjects as themselves nine parts dead. It's clear that for most or all of them, this is a distinctly taboo subject, a roped-off area into which their thoughts seldom wander. They equate suicide with misery and failure and cowardice, the act of moody teenagers and the weak and the ill. They view self-termination as an absolutely, positively last resort, and maybe not even then, whereas I, an eyes-open being, might view it as a third or fourth resort. I don't think I'd stick my head in the oven to get out of a speeding ticket, but I might do it to get out of a wheelchair, or a year in jail, or a bad case of the hiccups. It wouldn't, however, be based on a decision so much as an observation. Things come into a certain alignment. Patterns emerge. Rightness is perceived, and the clearly indicated course is followed. I've never not done something once I saw that it was the thing to do. And that includes much harder things than suicide. Despite not being a Bushido warrior kind of guy, I do have a clear and abiding awareness that today is a perfectly good day to die. Only that day dawns to which we are awake. If this seems like a light treatment of a heavy subject, it's because, from the integrated perspective, it's not so dark and dreary. There's no evil stink to death when it's out in the open where we can see it and hold it steadily in our sight. This is what it means to befriend death, to embrace it, that we acknowledge its importance in our lives. Not that we get to like it or look forward to it or develop some creepy resonance with it. The primary benefit of this honest relationship is the way in which it throws life open to us. But also important is the way it de-horrifies the specter of death. We're not talking about the commission of the act, but only the honest contemplation of it. The question of suicide, to be or not to be, is at the very heart of philosophical inquiry. But Maya has rendered it virtually unthinkable with a logjam of highly charged counterbeliefs. We have no right to terminate our own lives because life is sacred. It's an unpardonable sin and an abomination against God It's a cowardly act and a cheat. Whatever life lessons we escape now, we'll just have to experience in the next life. And so on. Rather than being unthinkable, however, suicide should be supremely thinkable. It is the thing that most needs thinking about. At the very least, we would want to break the logjam and make some decisions about it for ourselves. If we want to have some fun with spiritual autolysis, begin with the question, why shouldn't I kill myself right now? When all is said and done, I summarize for the group, all this talk of demons and boogeymen is just a way to slap ourselves into stark, raving sanity, to sober ourselves up from the intoxicating effects of belief and wrong knowing. The point is that wakeful lucidity is something we're all perfectly capable of achieving. If anything, it's seeing what's not, and not seeing what is that's so amazing. All we're talking about now is a way to stop performing this miraculous feat of self-deception, so we can see things as they really are. Spiritual autolysis focuses the mind, and memento mori gives it a known point to focus on. In combination with a sincere desire, they can set anyone on the road out of the segregated state of human childhood. So, if you want it, here it is. The only question is, do you want it? I've already decided I'm never going to die, jokes a young guy, but no one laughs. Get real, I almost reply, and I realize that this admonition is at the very heart of this whole crazy business. I could have just said that in the first place and saved myself the trouble of writing 3 books. That's what it all comes down to. Get real.